So that was New York City from John Lennon's Sometime in New York City album. Kind of roughly thematic of what we're going to talk about in this episode today. We're going to talk with Ken Daschau, who does the East Coast Tri-State area version of Breakfast with the Beatles. He's a friend of the program. And we're also going to talk to Mark Lapidos, who everybody hearing this should probably know who he is, the founder of Beatlefest back in 74, currently the fest for Beatle fans.
Yep, absolutely. My name is Richard Buskin.
This is Robert Rodriguez.
And this is Something About the Beatles.
And as also probably a lot of you listeners know, we have done the fest, both of us and individually, through the years.
Yep.
Chicago, for sure. Sometimes the East Coast, sometimes L.A. if it happens. I did Vegas 1 year. So
I didn't know you did Vegas, really.
I did, yeah.
Were you in your white jumpsuit?
No, that would have been you, Mr. Cowboy Boots. But I did the 1 year, and then I think it was the last year they did it. I think they only did it twice. But
My first year was 76. It was the second UK Beatle convention. The first one had been in Norwich.
Well, that was the Mark Lapidos Fest. That was... who was running that one?
Oh, boy.
Sam Leach?
I can't even remember, actually. But 75, I know, was the first one, I think, in Norwich in England. And then the second one was in London, Christmas of 76. That was like a monumental flop at Alexandra Palace.
And 75 was okay?
Apparently so, but I wasn't there for that one. But,
oh, okay. So the first one you did was 76?
Yeah, at the what we know as the Ali Pali, Alexandra Palace, and that was a big flop. And then after that, there were all these... ones in Liverpool, actually, which were organized by Alan Williams and Bob Wooler. So that was quite an experience to have those two guys, you know, actually
running the show.
Were you
conscious at the time when you were experiencing this, and you would have been a teenager or whatever you were, that these were basically historic figures that were walking around?
Yeah, but obviously not as, you know, I mean, I don't think they were as revered then as they might be now in a way. You know, it was current. It was the mid-70s, only a few years since, you know, the Beatles had broken up. And the cavern wasn't there. It was just literally, it was a car park and sort of a pile of rubble there, I think, with a really chintzy little statue up on the wall, Four Lads Who Shook the World. That was all that was there. Liverpool really didn't seem that interested in the Beatles. And, I mean, I remember, for instance, the 76 convention in London. During the auction, they had a Lennon lithograph for, I think it was like £25.
An original.
In a frame, an original. And I'm going, I think that's a bit too much.
These are the erotic lithographs?
Yeah, the erotic lithos, you know, and it was just one of them.
Uh-huh.
But it was still £25, which is like, you
Number
know,
69?
About like $40, $45, something like that.
Right.
And I'm humming and haring and decide not to get it. You know,
Little
did I know. But that's how it was before John died, to be honest with you. Once John died, everything changed.
Oh, of course. In our recent years, when Michael Jackson died, I remember people selling copies of Thriller for $1,000 on eBay.
Yeah.
As if you'll never, ever be able to find that million-selling album ever again.
Yeah.
You know, people are crazy. But things that are truly rare, I do remember a time in my fest going where you can buy a Stuart Sutcliffe original pencil sketch of something for under $100.
Yeah.
And me thinking to myself, oh, if that's all they're going for, I'll just get one when I'm ready to spend that kind of money.
Exactly.
And now,
yeah. Well, in fact, so John died, and I remember I was overseas. I mean, I went for that Christmas. I went away, and I had someone...
Because he died?
No, not because he died, but someone was bidding by proxy for me at an auction. And
wasn't it Ed Begley Jr., was it?
No. Actually, I'm thinking maybe it was actually Christmas of 81. Maybe it was a year after. It was Christmas of 81. And I was away and I had someone bidding an auction. There was a small drawing by John. I think it was like literally just a few inches square. And the reserve price on it was something like £135, which is like, you know, maybe about $200. And I said, yeah, you know, bid on that for me. And when I phoned after the auction to see if I got it, it's like, no, you didn't quite get it. Well, how much did it go for? And I can't remember exactly, but it was like 35,000.
You know? Oh, okay.
It's like, okay. Everything had changed.
Why didn't you bid more?
Yeah. Because I'm tight.
Mm.
Yeah. But those early Liverpool conventions were fascinating because I had, you know, one tour where Alan Williams was the, you know, one of the guides on the Magical History Tour around Liverpool, and we'd have Bob Wooler standing where the cavern had been, reminiscing and actually crying. In fact, I remember it was kind of sad. He had all the fans in. He started getting really nostalgic and saying, you know, that's where the girls would be down there loving them. And he started just to cry. And
I know it's meant to be poignant, and it probably was when you were experiencing this, but it's also like ripe for parody.
Oh, yeah.
Can you know, like an Eric Idle treatment of this very thing you're describing?
Well, actually, you say that. I remember I think the first interview I ever did with anyone was Victor Spinetti, who was in, you know, the Beatles' first two films, Hard Day's Night and Help.
Well, he'll talk to anyone.
Well, he would have done. He wouldn't now. So, but I interviewed him, and he said to me that, because he'd met me at a convention before that, I think in Sheffield in England, and he said to me, I told him that, you know, about the Bob Wooler thing, about Bob Wooler crying. And when I met him again and interviewed him, he said to me, oh, you know, I saw Paul recently, Paul McCartney, and I was mentioning to him some of the people who were at the convention. And he said, I couldn't remember the name of the DJ, but I told Paul there was this guy there and he was very nostalgic and kept crying. And Paul said, that must be Bob Wooler.
So that was his reputation?
Absolutely.
Yeah, he remembers his 21st birthday party, evidently.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He had lots of tears.
The first time he stopped crying.
Yeah, really. God, shame on you for laughing about that.
We can laugh now.
Yeah.
Or are you saying it's too soon? Okay, sorry.
Yeah, really.
But I digress. So we're going to talk a bit about the fandom as expressed through the fest, specifically by talking with Mark Lapidos. And I know that anybody who's read my book, Fab 4 FAQ 2.0, knows the story of the first Beatle Fest from there and the other subsequent tellings he's had at fests. But we're going to get a little more detail on Mark's background and just the how the whole fest thing happened. Because, you know, I know that there are people out there that will, you know, the longtime attendees that will have criticism of things about the fest, you know, and I think that's going to be that way about anything successful. You know, you're always going to think how it could be better or different or whatever. But to give credit where it's due, I think people should really recognize the fact that, but for this, where else would you meet the likes of a Victor Spinetti or a Patty Boyd or a Mal Evans or any of these as tight as you could possibly be within the Beatles circle? You know, Pete Shotton, the Quarrymen, not to mention authors, you know, because God knows we're high and mighty, but just you really get that kind of personal contact that you never would have the access to any other way.
Well, absolutely. I mean, in fact, you know, plugging your book, I'll plug my one, Beatles 101. In there, I've got photos from, I think, 77 or 78 in Liverpool. I've got Mona Best when we met her, Alan Williams on Matthew Street, you know, near the side of the Cavern. And then, you know, Beatles sites, actually, that I think Little and Town Hall, places like that no longer exist.
Oh.
So again, you know, now in retrospect, it's fantastic that, you know, I did attend those conventions.
Yeah, and it, for the people that were around in the 70s attending the fests as they were going on around the country, because it was actually, you know, New York is where it started. They did Chicago starting in 77. I believe L.A. started in 75 or 76. So there was a lot of cities that it did, you know, I don't know how many times, but they don't do it now. They've done Philadelphia. They've done Atlanta. You know, Vegas was more recent.
What was the Lapidos one in New York, the very first fest, though? Was it?
It was the first Beatle Fest. Now,
what about the Joe Pope?
The Joe Pope thing happened a few months before. Yeah. And I also write about this in 2.0. That was in July of 74 in Boston, I believe.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. So that was the Magical Mystery Tour. Yeah. And that's something, you know, Cindy Pope, his widow, we'll talk to her one day, get her on the show. Because Joe Pope, that's a whole other subject unto himself.
Yes.
You know, not just the fest thing. That's kind of like the least of it. Mm. He was the one that brought to the masses the Decca audition tapes as those series of Decagon singles. Uncolored vinyl.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's another thing that's it's another fascinating story, but we'll talk to Cindy at some point. But we have Mark today, and we also have Ken Daschow, you know, quite a knowledgeable guy when it comes to Beatles and music generally. Mm. And in fact, let's talk to him now.
People say, well, the Beatles were a boy band when they started out. Yes, they were the most popular boy band of all time. But imagine just a couple of years in, if One Direction wrote a song that began with the lyrics, "Turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. This is not dying." And quoted the Tibetan Book of the Dead and decided to stop touring because there was too much screaming and they wanted people just to hear the music. That's the difference, is that the Beatles were brilliant writers and brilliant musicians. All that pop music now aspires to is to be boy bands or girl bands and be famous. They want the fame. They don't have the artistic merit or quality or desire to get any further.
Yeah.
And which came first, radio or the music, in terms of moving to an FM, more creative, more interesting, more psychedelic way? I've always thought about that. Which was the horse, which was the buggy? And I think they both grew up together that way, is that the whole world, there was a cultural shift happening in the arts, and commercial art was being done at such a high level and was being accepted by the masses, not just in music, but think about the movies that were coming out in the late 60s and early 70s, from The Godfather and Five Easy Pieces. There were mainstream movies were really well done, really well written and well acted, and novels, the same thing of Norman Mailer and what was being done, questioning authority and not just escapism. And yes, that existed in Fighting Monsters, but people really putting a lot of effort and the population was following. My hero here in New York was Scott Muni, because a lot of DJs came from college and went to FM radio, which made absolutely no money. WNEW-FM didn't make a dime until rock became mainstream in the 70s. But Scott Muni walked away from a top job on AM radio in New York on WABC. He walked away from the money to start FM rock because he just saw that's where things were going and thought the music was more interesting. That, to me, is a real hero.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we all sort of say it's the old cliche about the Beatles, the right people in the right place at the right time. I mean, had they come along, I know, 10 years earlier, it would have been a whole different thing, wouldn't it, in terms of the radio scene? And also, had they happened today, it would have been different. I mean, describe, you know, I mean, it's hypothetical, but what do you think it would have been had they come along a bit too early, or if they were on the scene today?
It's a great question, and it's whatever word you want to use of fate or kismet, they were the right band. The only statement that they've ever made that I think is absolutely false, George Harrison once said, if we hadn't done it, some other band would have. No, some other band was Jerry and the Pacemakers. Some other band was the Rolling Stones. The Rolling Stones are the greatest rock band that have kept going that we'll ever know. They're brilliant. But they were playing blues and rock, and I love, this is a staple. But they weren't changing, you know, the course of music with every album that came out every year. They were going along in their own way and writing, and they got psychedelic, but on a Satanic Majesty's request. And to be honest, it did seem like the whole world waited to see where the Beatles went and then followed them in that direction. They, you know, Elvis was playing rodeos when the Beatles played Shea Stadium. You know, all these markers, the first stadium band, the first psychedelic band, the first band to bring Indian music into Western pop culture. There were all these markers along the way where we just saw, okay, we'll go that way now. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that they were ever, you know, it's always the case, isn't it, with artists and especially the A&R guys, what's going to be playable on the radio? Do you get a sense that the Beatles were really that mindful of it, or it was just radio would have to fall in line with what they were doing?
I mean, that's the joy of being that big. And I guess there's an ego to it, but there's an old baseball manager who of my favorite team, the New York Mets, who used to say, it ain't bragging if you can do it. That to me sums them up perfectly. Like, we are the Beatles, and if we write something great, wherever we take it, the world will follow. And they just did. And listen, on one hand, know what John always said, nobody wants the weight of having the world keep asking you, what should we do next? Follow your own, you know, follow your own muse. But on the other hand, they had that freedom of doing whatever they needed to do. And John cutting up tape and, you know, let's say the George Martin, let's put it in backwards. Let's just see what happens. I mean, nobody else would have ever, ever had the luxury to try it, much less put those results out there and the world saying, that's pretty cool. Let's go that way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, today's, you know, radio scene and TV for that matter is way more fragmented, isn't it? You know, you just don't have, you know, the nation listening to one thing or tuning into one thing. Do you think it would have been more difficult for them today, with today's sort of setup with the media, for them to have grabbed the attention in the way that they did back then in the mid-60s?
Absolutely. I think you're 100% correct. There was the double-edged sword of the system, if you will, of the music business, was when something was popular, they could stoke the furnace and feed it, and every record company had their bands that these were the lifers, and these were the pop artists of the day, and these were the bands that were, they were album bands, and the Beatles did both. And these days you've got Taylor Swift and a machine behind her, and Beyonce. There are a handful of bands or musical acts, or I shouldn't even say musical, but performing acts that do have that. But everybody else, the problem with a level playing field is, it's a level playing field. So that the kid in his basement in Birmingham and the kid in Evansville, Illinois, have the same shot, which means they both have to do all the work themselves. I've had so many young musicians or singers say to me, where's the next Brian Epstein? Where's the person who's going to guide me and, you know, grade the road for me to get me there? And the truth is, you have to do all that work yourself now. I think it's a million times harder to be heard now than it was before.
Yeah. It's just that whole thing. I mean, not just in terms of them, you know, you're not going to get another Beatles, but I mean, that just whole thing is never going to happen again, is it? You know, having the top five in the American charts, getting that kind of attention that is like that everyone is tuned into them, it's just never going to happen again.
No, that is a comet that comes once in a lifetime. And, you know, why? Was it a phenomenon? Was it a psychological phenomenon? And as you said, talking about it came along at the perfect time. America is in mourning after the Kennedy assassination. Mm. We're in the 60s, in 1964, and we're still reeling from this beloved president who's been assassinated, and we don't know what direction we're going in, and we've come out of the ultra-conservative Eisenhower 50s, and we just needed something desperately to lift up our spirits. And we had Elvis, but Elvis had been around and was doing the same thing. And here came something new, something from England, and the energy of it. It's the one thing that you can't design or capture. The energy and joy of their music absolutely lifted up this entire nation. That's why we didn't just embrace them, we ran to them as fast as we could.
And as you say, and then, as if that wasn't enough, they evolved with the scene and still led the scene, so that, yeah, they're doing Tomorrow Never Knows and they're doing Pepper and they're doing the stuff off the White album, and they basically led those times, but had they not led them, they would have been left behind.
I think so. I think there was a joy to running and moving forward. As Paul said, any time, like, he would suggest, hey, what if we combine two songs together? And John would say, we've done that already.
Yeah.
And like the worst sin that we, you know, and that was the worst sin we could ever commit is we've done that already. I think that's the nastiest knock one Beatle could give another, is that we don't ever repeat ourselves or go back. And I've had the good fortune in my 30-something career to interview just most of the musicians and most of the heroes of my day. And, you know, in any venue, in any sort of form of music, when I talk to Keith Emerson, and, you know, we talk about progressive rock, and he said, you know, we were the first ones to buy the new Yes album, and Yes were the first ones to buy the new Pink Floyd album, not to copy it, but to see where they went and to figure out how we could take the next step. You listen to the next Beatles album to see what they did to enjoy it, but then you go back to the pub with your mates and figure out, okay, how can we go further? And that's the one thing that I hear that's completely missing from the music scene today. I hear every act sort of trying to emulate and sound exactly like the other act, not see where else you could take it, or could you push it further and make them chase you.
So speaking of FM radio in the 60s, while the Beatles were happening, here is a bit of a stolen acetate aired on WABC around the time the White Album came out, or just before, apparently. And it seems they only had one disc of it, and they speculate what's on the other disc, suggesting it could be the Beatles jamming.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was low fidelity, but it's pretty cool anyway. Here's a little bit of it.
Okay, new Beatle album. Fidelity is not out of sight on this, but I think the music is excellent, at least in many parts. You make your own decision about that. I will have to cut in on the cuts occasionally in order to protect our sister station. Same thing we went through before, right? And we will be cutting our stereo beacon, because this is in monophonic low fidelity, and therefore it becomes necessary to so do to live up to FCC regulations. Are you ready? Stereo beacon, go off. Click, click. How does that feel? All right, here we go. In glorious monophonic sound, here are the Beatles. just for a second, Robin, huh? It's really amazing, and I think credit where credit is due, all right? You know, you could tell it was the Beatles, and that's about where it was at. I really like that cut. It's called Does It Mean You Don't Love Me Anymore? I have 12 tracks here on this dub that I have. And somebody reminded me, this is supposed to be a double album. And that would mean 24 tracks, which means that we probably have really only half the album here, and there's more to be heard. And I was just discussing with someone, what's your name? Yeah, I was discussing with Mike Frankel on the phone the possibility, which occurred to me, that the other two sides on the album may just be jam. Because that's what's happening in music today. So many good jam sounds. And, you know, groups getting together to play without charts or anything like that. Just let's see what happens. A little spontaneity. And one good jam session on an album would settle a hash of the people that have been detracting from the playing of George Harrison and Ringo Starr for a long time. I think George Harrison is one of the best guitarists I've ever heard. Certainly one of the greatest technicians. And Ringo, while he tends to be a little bit of a sloppy drummer, comes up with some really freaky things. An offbeat drumming. Really nice. And I would really dig it if that's what the second two sides are. So I don't even know whether I have the whole album here for you or not. I know I have 12 tracks, and I know some of them are real good. And you make up your own mind about that. Fourth track is called Desmond and Molly, subtitled Life Goes On. Let's see what you think. Let me comment that Rolling Stone had an article, came out yesterday, today, which listed a bunch of titles for the cuts in the album. And it's up to you. A lot of the titles which were in Rolling Stone cover songs which we have played tonight with different titles. Now, I don't know which ones are the correct titles, and nobody's going to know which ones are the correct titles until the album actually comes out and we see it, I guess.
Interesting guy, Ken, isn't he, actually? You know, quite, you know, a new perspective that he can bring to the show.
Yeah, and I know we've crossed paths before, but I am looking forward to, at the fest in March, I'll have a chance probably to actually talk to him and, you know, pick his brain a little more, because he's a really pretty smart guy when it comes to the history of radio and just the development of FM as it sort of, you know, paralleled the path of the Beatles' career as they stopped focusing on being a singles act and getting more into album-length musical statements.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, radio is the great communicator, the great uniter of people. Something we were talking about before, though, about like the fests and bringing fans together. For me, I don't know about your experience in the States, but for me, like in the UK, by sort of 72, 73, the fact that I was still a Beatles fan made me passé at school. You know, it was you know, it was like, God, you, the Beatles broke up years ago. You know, it's like 2 or 3 years, right? And it was almost like being in the wilderness until one day I was in a magazine store and saw up there on the shelf the Beatles Monthly magazine that had been resuscitated,
yes,
basically. And I was just blown away. The feeling that I got, you know, when I saw that was like, wow, you know, connection with other people out there.
Yes.
And so that was just before the first Beatle convention. So that was the first thing for me.
Well, I became a fan basically at the end of 73 into 74. The very first Beatle album I ever had was the Red Album, which I got as a Christmas gift at 73. Yeah. And that was my gateway. It led me to this exploration of their career, having, you know, soaked up four sides of those two double albums and then wanting to get the individual albums after that. But, you know, you're talking now 74 to 75. There wasn't much out there in the way of books.
No.
That you can count them pretty much on one hand.
Illustrated Record, Roy Kahn.
Yeah, Illustrated Record, All Together Now by Wally and Harry Castleman.
Yeah.
Something published in America called Growing Up with the Beatles.
Longest Cocktail Party.
Yeah, that was out there. Our library had that.
Yeah.
And Apple to the Core.
And, of course, the Hunter Davis book.
Yeah, Hunter Davis book, which I remember there was some people that were, you know, I was a kid, and there was older people that lived on my block who I happened to find out they had a copy of it on their bookshelf.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't lend it to me. Because they said, well,
they knew,
there's some adult stuff in there.
You wouldn't give it back.
No, because they were concerned that there was some F-bombs in there and it wouldn't be wholesome enough for a child to read. So they wouldn't.
They should have known. They should have known.
Oh, if they only knew.
Yeah,
my God.
Really?
Yeah. But
yeah, and for me also, the I mean, it's the Michael Brown book, you know, Love Me Do, which was really
Which I picked up at an early Beatle Fest I went to.
Yeah, and I had also someone actually gave me, knew I was a Beatles fan, and gave me almost the entire collection of Beatles monthly magazines that her daughter now no longer wanted. So they were the originals. I think went up to like issue number 68 or something. I had all of them.
Yeah, I remember the reprints being sold in the early 80s, and I was picking those up as I was able to find them locally here, and that was pretty cool because, you know, it enabled me to catch up on the story as it was being told. Yeah. And that's, I'm all about like getting the contemporaneous accounts of stuff rather than reading, you know, people's recollections 20, 30 years later.
Yes.
But when I think about it, I just missed the boat and being old enough to see the Dark Horse tour, to see when Mal Evans, you know, well, he never came to Chicago because he died before that happened. But when people like that, like really inner circle people, were attending as guests the Beatle Fests.
Yeah.
You know, eventually, you know, Cynthia, I don't think, ever came to Chicago, but she did go to some shows.
Yeah.
And eventually we got Patty. You know, Pete Shotton was huge. That was in the early 80s. And Mike McCartney, that was a great one. I remember Ray Coleman being a great guest when he did that Lennon biography.
Right.
And very approachable, very.
Yeah, absolutely.
Expressed himself well.
Yeah, I met Ray a few times.
Yeah. So anyway, we can go down memory lane about our fest experiences, but let's talk to Mark and hear what he has to say.
Mark Lapidos,
known to all of you listeners as the founder of Beatle Fest back in 1974, now known as the Fest for Beatle Fans, getting ready to gear up for the March show on the East Coast in Secaucus, back at the old stomping grounds. And we are going to, or I'm going to be there this time, and we're going to have a lot of guests. Hi, Mark. Can you hear us?
I can hear you fine.
How's sunny Florida?
It's very sunny.
No, that's excellent.
First thing I want to know, Mark, is are you back on Collins Avenue, where you first saw the Beatles back in 1964?
No, we're about 60 miles, 70 miles north of that. We're up in Delray Beach.
Wow, okay.
But the last time we were here, the four of us, where we took those steps on Collins Avenue, and we took a couple of pictures.
Wow.
All the girls, exactly how it happened.
And just to remind listeners about that story, was it that the Beatles were in their limo, weren't they, and you saw them in the limo?
Yes. Oh. Who was sitting where? Don't ask me.
There must be pictures somewhere. So, Mark, tell us about your fandom. I know that you were a fan before the Ed Sullivan Show appearances. How did that start? When did you first hear the Beatles?
I was up in the Catskill Mountains. It was Christmas and New Year fell on a Wednesday, so it means kids got 2 weeks vacation in that time of year. So we came back from the mountains where it's very difficult to get radio up there. And in the winter, the signal's even less, even 50,000 watt stations. In the summer, you can get Chicago got WABC, but maybe I didn't have my transistor radio with me. Maybe I forgot it, but I heard no music at all until I got back from the mountains, which was the 5th.
Mm-hmm. And so you were what, about 14 years old at the time?
I was a few weeks before 16.
Oh, okay. And what kind of music were you listening to pre-Beatles? What were you a big fan of?
Well, one of my favorite songs that I used to listen to all the time, I wore the record out almost, was the Isley Brothers' Twist and Shout.
Wow, that's funny.
But yeah, it was very funny. And in fact, to this day, I still love that version at least as much because I heard it so many times. You know, and to hear the Beatles do, it was wonderful. I liked rock and roll. I listened to Top 40 radio, and you know, I liked most of it. I went to the more of the rock side of it. But I liked plenty of pop stuff. We got everything as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
The only station you had.
Now, at that point, as a very intensely musical kid, did you have any particular career ambitions that you saw yourself doing once you got out of high school and into college?
None. Zero. Not at all. Never occurred to me. I was a junior in high school. But I, the exact moment that I heard I Want to Hold Your Hand, which was January 6th, Monday evening, at about 7:15 in the evening.
WABC chimes out 11 minutes past 6 o'clock.
I'm John, I'm Bob, I'm George, Arrigo. We love WABC.
Here are the Beatle hits on American Radio headquarters for the Beatles. I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand.
I was listening to Scott Muni,
mm-hmm.
the guy who founded WNEW-FM 3 years later, 4 years later, but he used to work for ABC right before Cousin Brucey.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I was doing my homework, sitting in my bed, and the music came on, and I sat up almost immediately. I said, what is this? If I could grab me. And I got so excited, I went to hear who was. What was I listening to? And by the end of the song, I was just already, whatever it was, I knew I had to get it. Mm-hmm. And he said, this is I Want to Hold Your Hand by a group from England called The Beatles. And my first reaction, my brain was, that's an unusual name.
Hmm.
And then the next day I came home from school, Tuesday was a new survey day. It was number one song. So the second time I heard it was number one.
Wow.
First time I heard it, I heard nothing about the Beatles coming because all that was wasted on me because there's no, I didn't watch TV during vacation. And I didn't have a radio. So anything with Beatles are coming, nothing. Didn't read papers, just hung out with friends and had a good time skiing or whatever we're doing on the holiday. And came back, and first time I heard anything about it was at that moment.
So you would have just missed the Jack Parr appearance, which would have been the Friday preceding.
Well, I probably wouldn't have known it was on.
During the 60s, when the band was together, did you do a pilgrimage to London to see the band?
In 69, my graduation gift to me, from college, my best friend at the time, and I went to Europe for 2 months. And the first place we went to was London. And the first day, we got up on Friday, June 13th, and went to Savile Row, Three Savile Row. That was the very first stop I insisted on. My friend was a very big Beatles fan, but not the hardcore kind that I was. Mm-hmm. So we went to Three Savile Row, and we walked in and saw the secretary. I said, hey, where are the Beatles? Well, George is on holiday in France. Paul's on holiday in Greece. It was one or the other. I know one was in France, one was in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
Ringo's home, and John and Yoko are in there, and points to a door about 8 feet away from me.
Wow.
So yeah, wait outside, and he'll come out. So I said, you have any souvenirs? She gave us a piece of Apple stationery, which I'm sure you've seen over the years.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So did you get to see them that day?
We waited outside, and while we're waiting, Robert, have you ever been over there?
Yes, I have.
Neil's office was that first window,
mm-hmm.
on the first, right there.
Yeah.
Well, that's where John and Yoko was. And it was Friday, June 13th. It was very hot that day, so the window was open, and John started playing guitar.
Wow.
Something brand new, with no idea what it was, but the fact that Abbey Road is going to be recorded in the next few weeks, it had to be something from Abbey Road.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a sneak preview, but I couldn't possibly tell you what that song was. You know, you hear a bit of a new song, you don't remember what it is.
Mm-hmm.
5 months later when you hear it on the radio, on the album.
Of course. This would have been just after he recorded Give Peace a Chance in Montreal.
Yes, exactly. And I knew that we wouldn't allow him in this country at that time. So a couple hours later, John walks out all by himself, and there was about 12 or 13 of us standing around, three genuine apple scrubs, which Bob and I could not understand half the what they were saying. We couldn't understand it. Their accent was so thick. But anyway, of all those people out there, basically John was the only one, I was the only one John spoke to.
Wow.
I had my passport in my hand. I had the same glasses. I was about the same height. I was thin in those days. My hair was pretty long. I said, John, here, my country needs you more than they need me. Looked at it and thanked me and gave it back to me. And I asked him, would you mind if I took a picture of you? He said, no. So I took some pictures, and I got an autograph. John signed the Apple stationery.
Wow.
So I have John's autograph on Apple Stationery. That was the first time I met him.
The Beatles Decade, 1964 to 1974. I want to hold your hand. Eleanor Rigby. With Sergeant Pepper's lonely hearts burning. Imagine. Together and on their own, The Beatles. For 10 years on Capitol and Apple Records and Tapes.
So when and how did the ideas first formulate in your head to stage a Beatle Fest?
November of 1973. I worked at Sam Goody, as you know, records, the biggest record store in the New York area and one of the biggest in the country. That, I mean, I wanted to work, and after I met John, I shook his hand also, by the way. I walked around London all night and said, I want to work for the Beatles. It was I looked at my hand and said, I just shook one of God's hands. And then 3 days later, we went back and we saw Ringo, but it was very brief. He didn't really talk to anybody, just walked in and out. And we also met Kyoko. She drove up all on that day waiting for John.
Wow.
In a limousine. So we saw her for a few seconds. So back to Sam Goody. I was sitting over near Thanksgiving weekend. And I said, over a dish of vanilla ice cream somewhere in the Upper East Side of New York, I said, you know, somebody should do something to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Beatles' arrival in America. And the word Beatle Fest popped into my head, and I got this vision of fans in a hotel celebrating a common love for the Beatles, you know, watching films and listening to music and guest speakers and listening, you know, talking about the Beatles, selling and buying stuff. And I sat with the idea for a few months, and in early 74 I said, why not? Let's do it. So I knew the first two questions people were going to ask me would be where and when. So I booked the old Commodore Hotel, which, as you guys know, were there this past year and is now the Grand Hyatt.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Same physical plot of land. Booked it for September 7th and 8th, 1974.
I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, do grant a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon for all offenses against the United States which he, Richard Nixon, has committed.
And I told people I was not going to do the show without their support. I wanted to get the Beatles' blessing. I didn't think it was right to do a show in their honor without contacting them. So I finally, long story short, I'm sure people at the fest heard the story last year for the first time. I told it in its entirety, but on April 28th, 1974, John Lennon and Harry Nilsson appeared in Central Park for the first March of Dimes event, and 100,000 people showed up.
Very important personages here at our show from WABC for March of Dimes. An appearance and a thank you from John Lennon.
Afterwards, I went up, knocked on the door, and Harry Nilsson opened the door, and he said, I'd like to speak to John about Beatle Fest. Come on in. So I sat down. A few minutes later, John came out. I reminded him that we had met before. He said, I don't remember. Meeting me as a kid in London, mm-hmm. 5 years earlier, some nerve. But after that rough start, I got off too. I told him the idea. He got very excited about it, animated about it, and I mentioned that I wanted to, you know, I'd do a charity raffle. He said, I have a guitar in my attic that I could sign and give to you, which he did. And he said, I'm all for it. I'm a Beatles fan, too. And that was it.
How did you actually find out which room he was staying in?
You didn't hear the story in New York last year or Chicago?
No, I was...
In fact,
no.
I told him all three cities.
He hasn't read my book yet, either.
It was a half hour. I told the whole thing. It had something to do with the fact that I worked at Sam Goody, and we had a Beatles sale that week, which every 2 months we had to do a sale at Sam Goody. And I found out about this 10th anniversary shirt that we're making, and nobody knew about it in New York, and even Capitol Records didn't know about it in New York. Like, I personally called the Tower in Los Angeles, Hollywood, and they said, yeah, we have them. I said, well, we were the biggest store in the whole probably in the whole country, the Radio City Music Hall store, right next to Radio City, 51st and 6th Avenue, was the Sam Goody store. So they sent me a whole box of them for just what I asked for. And I had control of them. It was in my office. Nobody could touch them, and only my salespeople had them. So when I saw this guy in the middle of Central Park wearing my shirt, I didn't recognize him. I asked where he got it. And the short story is that he found John and Harry wandering around Times Square, asked them if they needed a ride in place. Said, yeah, can you take us back to the hotel? They took him back. Then they talked for a few minutes. John signed a couple autographs and gave him one of these shirts.
Ah. So prior to lucking into meeting them at this March of Dimes thing, did you have any real design?
Let's not put it that way, because once Cousin Brucey announced it, Cousin Brucey was our guest this year also.
Yeah.
Last year. He was the one who interviewed John and Harry on stage at the Walk of the March of Dimes event.
Mm-hmm.
I told everybody I know, they knew, that I'm meeting John on Sunday. I'm going to tell him my idea.
Mm.
Everybody thought I was whacked, nuts, crazy.
So that was part of your game plan all along.
Anything in my whole life, I was completely convinced that I was going to meet John on Sunday. Didn't know how, but it didn't even occur to me that I wasn't. That's how certain I was.
Well, you had that in from 5 years before.
Right. No, but 5 years before, I mean, I waited outside his office, and that was to meet him. But I met him, you know, and then 10 years before, I had met John at least 3 or 4 or 5 times, because I was invited to all the Capitol Records parties, so Elephant's Memory and...
Oh, wow.
They had, like, private parties. So I had met him. You know, not hello, how are you, nice to see you again, just, mm-hmm. you know, how you doing? Like any fan would be.
Right. So by 74, by the time you're setting up the first fest, you'd already met John, as you described, and you had a brief encounter with Ringo. What about Paul or George?
I had not met them. In fact, the 2 days later, I was back in the suite. They called Neil in London to go over details.
Mm-hmm.
I told them what they needed. Just whatever you need, because Neil will take care of it. And we were on the phone for over 2 hours, talking to Neil. And one of John's and Ringo's close assistants, Hillary. Richard, you probably know Hillary.
Yeah, Hillary Gerard.
Yes, great guy, really nice. And he was talking to Neil about all this whole event. John loves the idea. We're going to do it. And within a week or two, I got Ringo's autographed drumsticks sent to me directly. About a week or two before the show, Tony King, who was assigned to me to be the official Apple representative, he was the vice president of Apple in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
I met him, I think the 1st or 2nd of August, after one night after Sam Goody, he was staying at a hotel nearby. So I knocked, we arranged to meet after dinner, after work, and I knock on the door, and he's there, with a guy named Elton John.
Oh, wow.
Sitting talking to Elton John about music for 2 hours. It was, like, wonderful. I'd never had such a long conversation with someone who was, in 1974... Yeah, he was the number one artist on the planet at that time. And I didn't know that he was going to the recording studio a couple of days later to record Whatever Gets You Through the Night. And he didn't share that information, of course.
Right.
He didn't know it. But it was great talking music about him. You know, he had the number one album. The Caribou album was number one. Wow. While I was talking to him, I said, what's the next single? I said, You're So Static? He said, no, that's the one he wanted. But... he said, Ditch is back, it broke out somewhere in the Midwest, and it's all over the place, so we got that one out.
Wow. Very cool.
Then he came with, and then he said, you sell cassette players. I mean, he had piles and piles of cassettes. When he says he travels with music, he wasn't kidding. He really does. And he said, do you sell cassette players at Sam Goody? He said, yes. The next day, I had to be at the warehouse at Sam Goody, and he walks into the store and asks the other manager, he said, is Mark Lapidus here? And he was in the store for over an hour shopping. He bought records. One girl, he was looking at the record, the 45 department. You could buy oldies at the time. Mm-hmm. And some girl asked him, didn't know who it was, didn't look up, said, do you have a record? And he found it for her.
Wow.
Of course, the other managers were up front the whole time. They were not going to leave the front area. The girl pays for the record, and the manager says to her, did you see who helped you? She said, no. So why don't you look up? So she looked up. he bought tons of stuff. He bought a cassette player, and I wasn't there to see it all.
Oh, jeez.
It really bummed me out. But that was a thrill. So Tony was our representative. He called me about a week before the show. He said, did you get all your instruments? He said, he has John's instrument. Do you have the other ones? I said, no, I got Ringo's drumsticks, so I didn't get anything from Paul and George. So he said, I'll get back to you. So he tells John. John calls Paul and George and says, how come you haven't said anything to Beatlefest? They're going to raise the money for charity. He said, we didn't know anything about it.
Huh.
He didn't get through their line of people. So John took care of himself. He says, you got to have something here. Ringo and I have already sent stuff. So John found the tablet that George used. With any without you, we signed it. So this was George's tablet that he used in Sergeant Pepper album, and signed it. And then this is, he had another guitar, Paul's, I think it was a Spanish guitar or something, from the 60s, an old guitar. Well, of course, it was the 1970s, so of course it was going to be from the 60s, that John signed for Paul.
Huh.
And the first show was a complete sellout, and it was the cover story of Rolling Stone.
Do you think the Beatles are worth all this hubbub?
Definitely.
Why?
They're more than worth it.
Why?
There should be more of this. Because they're the best group that there ever was, and there won't be any better group ever.
Now, how close, the story was that John had planned on coming down but changed his mind at the last minute.
Absolutely true. 100% true. Tony brings the guitars and the tablet on Saturday morning. I was a nervous wreck. I was about to heave. You know how John used to say he would throw up before going on stage?
Yes.
I was so nervous. I had no idea what was happening. I couldn't, you know, it was like, I had no blueprint on how to do this. You know, this was a new idea. So I did it all, and we started at 1 o'clock on Saturday, and I was just a wreck. This was like 11, 12 o'clock. I still hadn't been downstairs yet, and I was just so nervous. And Tony comes in and shows me the guitars and says, hey, John has all, he signed me 6 Penguin John Lennon books for you to raffle off, you know, for the auction off for charity. And he said, he wanted you to have this personally. And he gave me a 7th copy. And it said, to Mark with love, September Beatles Fest 1974, John Lennon. And he drew a nice little drawing on the book.
Fantastic.
Which I had with me in New York City last year, and I showed to people. I never take it out of the vault, and that's my most valued possession.
Wow. Now, did you ever have any encounters with John after that?
Yes. A few months later, the opening for Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band at the Beacon Theater.
Mm.
It was opening night. We had tickets for it. We were invited there. And we actually had better seats. I think my brother and I went. We had better seats than John. I was a couple of rows in front of him. And before the show started, I went over and talked to him and thanked him personally. And just filled him in on how the show went. Because I know he heard about it from me.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to tell myself. And I thanked him so much. And the next year, I contacted him again. He sent, I think the second year was the transcripts for How I Won the War, the thing that he did with Victor Spinetti.
Oh, In His Own Right, the play?
No, it was 2 things that he did. Yeah, In His Own Right, and it was whatever it was, that's what he signed, the original manuscripts.
Right, the script or something.
And he contributed, he sent some more in 78 and 79. 79, he sent a message, my friend Roger Berkeley, just on the other day, yesterday, as a matter of fact, down here, saw John at a fish market, because he lived also on the Upper West Side. And he said, John, Beatlefest is this weekend. You have a message for the fans? He said, yes. Tell them the music was the thing. How could they, who could ever think to say to say it so clearly and so succinctly? The music was the thing.
Yeah,
it's just amazing. So I've used that quote many times over the years.
Now,
it starts with music. So there you go. There's the history.
After that first fest, which obviously is extremely memorable for you, which other fests have stood out for you? I mean, for me, you know, I was attending Beatle Fests in the UK from 1976 onwards, but the first US one was the February 81 fest in Secaucus, which obviously was the one just after John died. So it was very emotional and it was packed out. So that really stands out as a memory for me. What about for you? What are the fests that stand out for you?
It's no question that was the most important convention we ever did. We didn't know how we could do it. I mean, we looked at each other and said, we can't go on, but it's the fans who urged us. We need it. We need it more than ever. So Carol and I decided to do it, and we decided to send a letter out like we used to do before catalogs. We sent only the letter, and we said we are making no public announcements for this show. No press would be alerted about it, and nothing would be announced any place. We didn't want it to turn into a zoo, and we were all so oversold that we had to call people and said, "Can you come Sunday instead of Saturday?" We couldn't fit anybody, so that's what we did. People said, "Yeah, I can come Sunday instead of Saturday," and it was just for the fans, and Jimmy Fink was our MC then, and I wish I could remember exactly what he said. He said something like, at the beginning of the show, he said, this is an ordeal we all have to deal with, we're all dealing with it together, so let's have a moment of silence, and then let's kick ass and lock out for John, because it's the Beatles music that'll live forever. And now that I think about it, I got to get Jimmy to get to tell me exactly what he said, because it wasn't that, but maybe that was the essence. But it was really the way he said it. It was really very emotional, and we got through it. Yeah, we all had, you know, it was lots of tears and lots of hugs, and but being there we were like a giant family.
Yeah,
we were. It was that way. To this day, it's like a family reunion.
Yeah.
That's what makes it so special. But, you know, that was a tough one. The ones that stand out, the many, many ones stand out, with guests of Mal Evans the second year. It was only a one convention idea. This wasn't an idea for a business plan. This was a one show idea.
Huh.
But again, the people spoke, and after Rolling Stone, we started getting letters. We got no emails, by the way, no Facebook announcements. Yeah. Just mail and some phone calls. I guess the phone number got out there also. Mark, you got to do it again. You must. We had the best time of our lives. And so I decided to, okay, I did it again in New York. And then people started saying, bring it to Chicago, bring it to L.A., bring it here and there. And
it went viral.
I started doing it. And 122 conventions later, we're still doing it. The other highlights, having Mike McCartney as a guest was very special. All of them had their special things, but I think the New York City show last year was could have been our best show ever.
It was pretty amazing.
Well, Mark, thanks so much for joining us. You know, really appreciate it. This is fascinating stuff.
Okay. Well, nice talking to you guys. And people know where to get to us at thefest.com, I'm sure. And you guys have a great day. Rich, we won't see you till Chicago?
That's correct. Yeah, I can't make this one, but you see me in Chicago.
Okay, and Robert, we'll see you in March.
Yep, I will see you soon.
Robert Rodriguez, one of the guys at the other end of this phone, will be there. So if for no other reason, well, hopefully there's a few other reasons. Come on down to the fest in March, the weekend of March 20th through 22nd. And peace and love, peace and love.
Peace and love.
Peace and love.
Thanks, Mark. Take care.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
what memories he has, you know, especially the stuff with Lennon, that's just phenomenal.
Well, this is the thing. You know, he's been threatening to write a book forever, and I'm going to make it happen. We're going to do this. And he's a guy that...
Was it going to be called Lapidus FAQ?
Yep, there you go. That's perfect. The need-to-know guide. Yes, yeah, everything you need to know. But that's going to be awesome because, my God, all the people he's been in touch with. I remember the Harry Nilsson fests as of 81, maybe 82 as well. It seems like he was there more than once. That in the wake of John's death, when he did that single for anti-handgun causes with a bullet.
Yeah.
And he was selling kisses and selling buttons. And he signed my copy of Aerial Pandemonium Show or whatever it's called, that first album. And he did it with a pen that kind of smeared, which I'm kind of resentful of, but there it is.
I remember you trying to sell kisses, but that's a whole different subject.
Well, right. It didn't satisfy people. I had to escalate to the next level.
Yeah.
And that's where I made my fortune.
Yeah.
But it's cool stuff like that. And I'm sure all the backstage stuff that goes on, you know, Mark's going to be full of these stories and Carol.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it'd be great for them to get this all on paper for us to all to enjoy.
Yes.
But anyway.
So what are we going to play out with?
What can we play out with that's suitable to this theme here?
All Together Now?
All Together Now? Sure, why not? It's a good ending song, isn't it?
Sure is.
Not one of my favorites, but I did see Paul play it on tour a couple years ago.
Really?
He did, yeah. And there's something about even songs that you might be mediocre about, if you hear the artist performing them live, it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So I have to say that it elevated it for me to see him do it live.
Just a shame it's not preceded by that fantastic clip with all four Beatles at the end of Yellow Submarine.
Yes. Yes, and or extended version of It's All Too Much.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Yeah, thanks. We'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.
All Together Now, this is a copy of the Master Remix. One, two, three, four. Can I have a little more? Five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, I love you. A, B, C, D, can I bring my friend to tea? E, F, G, H, I, J, I love you. Sail the ship.
Something About the Beatles, recorded at Strad Studios, produced by Thomas Rapetney. Executive producer, Rick Way. Title song recorded by the Corgis.